Tonight, let us focus on the family, the faith, the upbringing of David Livingston. The hero of the Battle of Waterloo, the Duke of Wellington, described David Livingston as the fighting parson. Jacob Wainwright, who was one of the people who was rescued from slavery by Dr. David Livingston, described him as the friend of the African. I've heard a number of people describe him as the best friend Africa ever had. American journalist and explorer extraordinary, Henry Morton Stanley, described David Livingston as a truly pious man, a man deeply imbued with real religious instincts. His religion is of the true, practical kind, never losing a chance to manifest itself in a quiet and practical way. Never demonstrative nor loud, which is always at work, if not indeed by shining example. Stanley described his own attitude when he first arrived in Africa as prejudice against religion as the worst infidel. However, the example of David Livingston, who had truly left all to follow Christ, converted Stanley. Stanley was a skeptic who had been brought up in a very abused background, horrific upbringing, serious abuse, a man who did not know any human love for years and years, and he was a journalist, and he came for a story, and he thought the story would be to expose Livingston as a hypocrite, and he found he's the real deal. When somebody criticized Livingston as a failed missionary, lost explorer, who'd never had a convert, Stanley spoke up and said, that's not true. He knew where he wasn't lost, we didn't know where he was. He said, as for no converts, he said, I'm one of his converts. David Livingston was hailed in his lifetime as the greatest missionary explorer of all time. It would be hard to think of any close second. As one contemporary journalist described it, the Christian's faith in God is strengthened by Livingston's very survival of every imaginable danger. The abolitionist is inspired by the prospect of stopping the slave trade. Was the ever more energetic campaign against the slave trade. Medical men are intrigued by Livingston's approach to disease and the value of his treatment of fever, which indeed was pioneering. The incredible courage and sacrifice of David Livingston inspired multiplied hundreds of men and women to dedicate their lives to missions, particularly in Africa. So what can we learn about the family and the upbringing of David Livingston? To understand his faith, his courage, and his vision. David Livingston was born the 19th of March, 1813, in the industrial town of Blantyre, 8 miles from Glasgow. His father, Neil Livingston, was a dedicated Christian who met his future wife, Agnes, when he was apprenticed to a local tailor. He won the hand of the tailor's daughter and became a tea salesman so that he could travel and preach the gospel, distributing evangelistic tracts to his customers as he went door to door selling tea. It seems he was probably a better evangelist than tea salesman, because he was always poor, but boy, he won a lot of people to the Lord. Neil also taught at Sunday school and was a zealous member of the local missionary society, persistently promoting prayer meetings and missionary causes. So David Livingston didn't just appear in a vacuum. David Livingston later wrote concerning his father, he deserved my lasting gratitude and homage for presenting me from infancy with a consistent, pious example. Neil Livingston was also a strict disciplinarian who sought to bring up David in the fear of the Lord, as you'd expect from the Scottish and from his strict Calvinist congregational background. He did not spare the rod. At age 9, David was challenged to learn the longest chapter in the Bible, Psalm 119, which, if you hadn't noticed, is 176 verses, off by heart in order to receive a copy of the New Testament. And he did. He managed to get the whole thing right with only 2 errors the first time and the second time with only 1 minor error and 1 the New Testament. Because Neil had seen the ravages of alcoholism, he was a teetotaler and he persuaded his son to follow his example in abstaining from alcohol for life. Very appropriate if you're a tea salesman, be a teetotaler while you're about it. David's mother, Agnes, was a gentle, small, delicate woman whose compassionate kindness and loving nature served as a counterbalance to her husband's strict and austere rule. It is also said that her son David inherited her remarkably bright eyes. Agnes instilled in her family a scrupulous concern for cleanliness and immaculate appearance, which is why he could hike across the continent and arrive smart, dressed with tie and jacket at the other end. Interestingly enough, Henry Morton Stanley made the statement to his men as they were embarking on their 999-day expedition across the heart of darkness in the Congo. David Livingstone shaved every day in the field, and you will shave every day in the field. Hear that? Going into the heart of darkness. You will shave every day. So he said. And, at least if there were going to be food for the cannibals, there would be neat and clean food for the cannibals. David was born during the last years of the ruinous Napoleonic Wars, which devastated Europe. So he's born 1813. Napoleonic Wars carried on until 1815. The economic impact of 25 years of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars left many unemployed in Britain, and it left an economically depressed environment. During the war, they had to produce cannon and cannonballs and gunpowder and ships, and people who drafted an army, and yes, but the moment the war ended, the war economy collapsed, and there was a lot of depression, which of course led to the 1820 settlers coming out the Eastern Cape, but that's another story. The Livingstons lived a very frugal life on a minuscule budget. The Livingston family lived in a single room, this room, 10 feet by 14 feet. This is the whole, for seven family members. Three girls, two boys, father and mother. Father and mother's bed above, all other mattresses were stowed underneath and were pulled out at night around the floor. Seven people in a room 10 feet by 14 feet, and that was it. There was no bathroom, there was no shower, there was no kitchen. This was it. In this room, this was everything. This is the whole family's home. Two baby boys had died in infancy. David had an older surviving brother, John, another brother, Charles, and two sisters, Janet and Agnes, born after David. Now, I heard people saying, this was Livingston's home. Well, yes, but they had one room shared with another 23 families, so 24 families sharing this tenement. There was neither hot nor cold running water in the tenement building. David had to walk many times a day down a tightly curved brick staircase to fetch the water from the pump in the yard. This is the only source of water for this tenement. He went back up the stairs and along the corridor to the third floor to their room. They were at the very top floor and in one corner. The Livingstons shared the tenement with 23 other families, so 24 in total, and at night mattresses were pulled out from under the parents' bed, which was set into a recess in the wall. Privacy was non-existent. The family cooked, ate, sewed, studied, slept in that single room. You know, I've heard people saying that they're poor. I don't know how many people have been poorer than the Livingstons. This picture is a little imaginative, you know, like the mother had another room to open and say, David, what are you doing up there? In fact, they had to take his candle away from him regularly because he was reading late and keeping the whole family up. But it wasn't like she came in from another room with some lighting behind. Anyway, just an imaginative picture. But they did normally have you stop studying after 12. Because the bell rings at 5:30 in the morning and everyone's got to get up at 5:30. So, you know, 12 was, that's it. Candle out. David Livingstone borrowed extensively from the local library, particularly books on travel and science. William Wilberforce's practical Christianity had a major impact on his life. So remember, William Wilberforce would have been a senior. He was in the lifelong crusade against slavery. And so William Wilberforce's example inspired David Livingstone to think of dedicating his life to fighting slavery. Clearly, Wilberforce's book and example influenced Livingstone's lifelong crusade against the slave trade, which explains why when he met slave traders, he set captives free. He burned their gory neck braces that were on the banks of the Malawi River in Kota Kota Bay and Monkey Bay. He opened fire against Muslim slave traders when he needed to. He set captives free. He was primed to fight slavery because of his upbringing and the books and example of William Wilberforce. A story about Livingstone's early life. Now, his mother kept him out of school as long, his mother kept him out of work as long as she could. Child labor was normal, And so he was being homeschooled till about age 10. But age 10, he had to start working full time. When you say full time, I mean 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's more like what we would call overtime. But before he turned 10, he was about 9 years old. He was reading on the banks of the Clyde River. And he was startled by the cry of a girl. And he saw a young girl with a baby brother who were having an adventure in a rowboat, but they'd just lost the oars. And the boat was drifting towards the paddle wheel of the mill and would doubtless be crushed. Seconds counted. David didn't hesitate. He plunged into the icy river. I mean, this is Scotland. It's cold. Into the icy river, rescued them both, took them back to home and never said a word about it. Never wrote about it, never referred to it. Only reason we know about this incident is because later Neil Livingston was asked to write a testimonial to his son, and he happened to mention this anecdote that the parents of the little girl and boy that he had saved came round to thank him. Otherwise, they wouldn't have even known. David never even mentioned the incident. We have this because it was in the London Missionary Society Ethics Files and was discovered a few years ago. Just an anecdote from his youth before he even started full-time work at age 10. So at age 10, David began his full-time employment, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, for the next 10 years at the Monteith and Cotton and Company cotton spinning factory. He was to be a piecer to repeat broken threads in spinning frames. David's day began at 5:30 a.m. when the bell rang, and they were in a tenement. Everyone in the tenement worked in the cotton mill. Work would begin at 6 a.m. and continue till 8 p.m., and the workers in the cotton mill had to work in tremendous heat and humidity, which was considered essential for the production of thread. Steam temperatures of 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. What would that be in centigrade? You live in Manx Fahrenheit, so we don't think in Fahrenheit. Hot. So every day, David would have to walk an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling, stooping position amongst and under and over the machinery or balancing on it. So imagine what a tremendous physical train this was for his later transcontinental expeditions across Africa. Walking 34 k's a day for 10 years. That's some training. Pieces received constant beatings from their supervisors. They thought that, you know, whipping them helped keep them awake and focused. And this wasn't considered child abuse or unusual, and nobody seemed to mind the fact that the kids are getting whipped at work because, you know, policy meant to keep them awake and productive during the day. Despite fatigue and exhaustion, they had to keep going. I mean, a 14-hour shift is quite long, so I suppose they considered this as part of the motivation. Yet, what did David, at age 10, do with his first week's wages? He purchased rudiments of Latin. I mean, my first salary at age 17, I can think what I bought. I actually bought a suit and a black briefcase and a black umbrella. Strange things we do with our money, but that was at age 17. At age 10, his priority was a book on Latin. David managed to read in the factory by bouncing his book on a portion of the spinning jenny so he could catch sentence after sentence as he rushed by at his work. So, and the girls working in the cotton factory decided to irritate him regularly, and so they'd throw things to knock his book off the perch. It would fall off there and see if they could get him angry and upset. And so that was just one of the irritations he had to deal with. In this way, he maintained fairly constant study, understood by the roar of the machinery. Historically, less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read and write. Just read and write, less than 10%. David not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. After work, he had attended night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then he returned home to study, often till midnight. His mother frequently had to take away his books before he would go to sleep and snuff out the candle. At age 12, David Livingston came under intense conviction of sin. He experienced a radical conversion to Christ. He wrote, "In the glow of love that Christianity inspired, I resolved to devote my life to the alleviation of human misery." He wrote that the salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. He made a resolution that he'd give to the cause of missions all that he might earn beyond what was required for his subsistence. Now, not that he's earning much anyway. At age 13, he attended an extra Latin class. When all the other students gave up, he alone remained in the class, and the school teacher cancelled the lessons, not seeing the overzealous son of a tea merchant as worthy of his attention. But David continued to learn Latin on his own. I think the teacher must regret that decision. David's grandfather, Neil Livingston Sr., also had an impact on the upbringing of David. He had been a tenant farmer on the island of Ulva, off the west coast of Scotland. But he is evicted by the English to open up the area to be a vast sheep farm. They might think he might have instilled some bitterness or resentment in his grandson. Not at all. He passed on what he had heard from his grandfather. "I've searched most carefully through all the traditions of our family. I never could discover there was one dishonest man amongst any of your forefathers. If therefore any of you or any of your children should take to dishonest ways, it will not be because it runs in our blood. I leave this precept with you. Be honest." This is the real kind of Spartan Scottish upbringing. Another man who influenced David Livingston was Thomas Burke, an old soldier, veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, who would ring his bell to shatter the peace and quiet of Blantyre every morning to rouse people to attend his early morning prayer meeting. I can't imagine a man like that would have been that popular. I mean, can you imagine? You're talking about Sunday, the one day of the week that people have any time off. Gadang, 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 calling people to prayer meeting. But while Burke was abrupt, direct, and challenging, the Livingston family faithfully supported him and attended his prayer meetings without fail. Another person who impressed David Livingston was David Hogg, who from his deathbed challenged the young boy, "Now, lad, make religion the main everyday business of your life. Not a thing of fits and starts, for if you do not, temptation and other things will get the better of you." 1832 was a special watershed year for the Livingston family. Neil Livingston, not satisfied with the spiritual life of the Church of Scotland, changed his church membership to the Free Church, effectively a congregational church. This required Livingstons to walk to Hamilton, a nearby village, for their Sunday worship services, not having in Blantyre such a congregational church. Although they received many invitations to dine with the families of the congregation, they chose to carry their own food and not impose upon the limited resources of the other families of the congregations, who they knew were also struggling financially. This is something about, it's not just the Scottish. Picked it up from my father too. This attitude of not wanting to accept charity. It's obviously a form of pride, but there's this real, and it's a thing of a previous generation. You won't find it much these days, where the people are so determined not to impose on others. Now, I think they overdid it, personally. There's a place for Christian fellowship. So interesting, that's the upbringing. So after Sunday lunch, the Livingston family were treated to the one luxury, a barley sweet each. One barley sweet a week. This is their treat. The Free Church at Hamilton were strong supporters of missions. By 1833, William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against slavery was successful. Slavery was abolished throughout the British Empire by Act of Parliament, setting free many slaves, particularly in the West Indies, such as Jamaica. This inspired ever greater visions for missions. Those who had been freed from physical slavery now needed to be freed from spiritual slavery. Missionaries were needed to go to the ends of the earth. Books and tracts from the revival movement sweeping America reached Scotland, and this created much excitement and the deepening of spiritual life and vision. David Livingston received a pamphlet written by Carl Gustloff of the Netherlands Missionary Society. In it, Gustloff appealed for medical missionaries to go to China. David was inspired by how a medical missionary could be much more effective in converting the lost. He had learned enough Latin to be able to understand most medical terms, which of course were all in Latin. He was remarkably well read. He had easily passed university entrance requirements. Entrance requirements to university then was to be able to debate in Latin. He could do that. His chief obstacle would be lack of finances. Through great determination, he saved most of his money during the next 18 months to be able to put himself through medical school and theological college. Now, I say this because I have read these little thin abridged missionary biographies on Livingston, so on, as a new Christian. I remember saying, Livingston received the bursary to study at college. There were no such things as scholarships and bursaries back then. And even if there were, this Scotsman would not have accepted it. No, he worked and put himself to college. Nobody gave it to him. I think there's some writers today who assume that what we do today and what's normal today has been the way it has been all the history. So anyone who gets a university degree must have had someone else pay for it. You know, this kind of attitude. But no, it's got to boggle the brains of most people that he could not only put himself through theological college but medical school. And he passed in record time. At age of 23, David set out on foot to begin his theological and medical studies in Glasgow. From 1836 to 1838, he benefited from the best theological and medical training available at that time. Some of it might have been a little basic, like they knew nothing about the tropical diseases he had begun to encounter, but it was the best they could give at that time. Each weekend, he had walked back home to Blantyre. Although he was frequently offered lifts, rides in a horse and cart, David would refuse, preferring the long walk, often in the snow, in order to strengthen his muscles for his career in missions. After all that training for 10 years in the cotton mills, he wasn't going to let his muscles go soft now that he is studying. So he'd rather walk the 8 miles between his home and college each week, Monday morning there, Friday afternoon back and so on. They had 6 day college weeks, it wasn't 5 days. So Saturday afternoon coming back. In his second year at college, David applied to the London Missionary Society. David's father was concerned that his son's application had omitted important facts, and so without his knowledge, Neil Livingston wrote to the London Missionary Society board informing him of his son's diligence in attending night school lectures, refusing offers of a lift to school or town, his refusals of secure teaching posts offered him. He was so well read, he was offered jobs as a teacher, he would have much more secure income and so on. And early on, he had a quest for Latin proficiency, even while working 14 hours a day in the cotton mill, and of his hard work, sacrificial lifestyle, and dedication study. We've got these forms, letters there, in the London Missionary Society archives. In response to the question of whether or not he is married or engaged, this sort of gives you a bit of an inkling to his mindset at the time, David Livingston wrote to the LMS, "Unmarried, under no engagement relating to marriage, never made proposals of marriage, nor conduct myself so to any woman as to cause her to suspect that I've intended anything related to marriage. And as so far as my present wishes are concerned, I would prefer going out unmarried, that I might be without that care which the concerns of the family necessarily induce and give myself wholly to the work." I mean, all I wanted was a yes or no, but it gives you a bit of an idea of the mindset that he is in. He is so diligent, so focused, so intense. 8 months after his application, David was finally invited to London, 30th of August, 1838, for an interview. I mean, 8 months, that's quite long to wait for a response, even back in snail mail time. After the second interview in September, the directors accepted Livingston on probation. He was placed under the mentorship of Reverend Richard Cecil, who described David as having sense and quiet vigor, whose temper is good and his character substantial. However, at his first preaching opportunity, David froze in the pulpit, abruptly declared, "Friends, I've forgotten everything I had to say," and hurried out of the pulpit. Hard to imagine a man who was such a great missionary having failed at his first public speaking engagement. So take heart if you've floundered in the pulpit. Better people than you have done it before. The directors of London Missionary Society seriously considered rejecting his candidacy over this freezing in the headlights. However, a wise man pleaded hard that his probation should be extended and at future preaching engagements, David Livingston proved to be capable and an energetic communicator. Now, one lady in Ongar wrote of David Livingston, "I never knew anyone who gave me more the idea of power over men. Such powers our Savior showed while on earth, the power of love and purity combined." During his studies, David wrote to sisters, urging them to seek to be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. "Let us seek, and with the conviction that we cannot do without it, that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will, crucified. That holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. That is what we ought to strive after, That is the way to be happy. That is what our Savior loves. Entire surrender of heart. May He enable us by His Spirit to persevere until we attain it. This is a letter to his sisters. It's noted that David earnestly sought first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. He steadfastly sought the Lord's will for his life. He persevered through every problem. David Livingstone was described as an idealist, an eccentric bookworm loner. He took his task and his calling most seriously. Whatever he did, he performed thoroughly. His character was uncompromising. He was inflexible to his adherence to his word. He said what he meant what he said. Dr. Rishton Bennett of the Royal College of Physicians described David Livingstone as pure and noble, simple, modest, unassuming, and self-reliant. Dr. Bennett wrote that he was struck by the amount of knowledge that David Livingstone had already accumulated of those subjects which constitute the foundation of medical science. David Livingstone's plans to be a medical missionary to China was frustrated when the Opium War erupted. By the way, the Opium War was a really wicked war. The British government was coaxed, bribed, or whatever, into offering the Royal Navy and British Army as mercenaries to the Rothschilds' wicked, ruinous plans of smuggling opium into China. You see, China was closed, and China was not interested in trading with the West. It weren't interested in trading with anyone. The word foreign and devils is a compound noun in China. Foreign devils. The West had nothing that China wanted. And so China wasn't interested in trading. And the West wanted their spices, their satin. They wanted all these different things that you could only get from China. And so silk and so on. So the Rothschilds came up with smuggling and opium, getting a vast amount of Chinese addicted to drugs. And of course the Chinese resisted this, which of course they should. And then Britain declared war on China to force them to accept the Rothschilds' merchant vessels that were smuggling in opium. So opium war was a wicked war. You can only think of the other time that the Rothschilds conned the British Empire into providing them with mercenaries, and that was the Anglo-Boer War, to lay waste to the Transvaal and the Free State in order to gain control of the golden diamonds for the Rothschilds, which is absolutely wicked. Oh, you can be sure that it's an army that's what they're fighting for. I mean, it could just be China has created an incident, they've attacked some of our citizens, which they probably did, because they probably sunk some Rothschild boats that were smuggling in opium, which is the right thing to do. And next thing, the British government, who knew that the Rothschilds were doing, you know, drug dealing, for goodness sakes. Do you know that the head of the KGB back in the Soviet Union time had as one of the biggest projects the drugging of America? You must get books like Red Cocaine. The Soviet Union smuggled drugs into the United States and Europe in order to break down the morale of people who had served in the military. Right now, I believe, or at least a few years ago, the head of the secret police in Cuba was running the cocaine industry smuggling into America. Just seen as something they would do to undermine the enemy. We know that Red China is involved in smuggling drugs such as opium and cocaine and others into America right now. But back in the 1830s, 1840s, it was being done by the Rothschilds, who were the banksters in Britain. And instead of just hiring their own mercenaries, they conned or bribed the British government to just mobilize the Royal Navy to do the dirty work for them, which is, of course, scandalous. Nevertheless, what man means for evil, God can use for good, and in no way trying to alleviate the guilt of the British government in this, it had a radical effect which affects us in Africa. David Livingstone, who is his whole life and studies aiming to go to China, suddenly had the door closed and he couldn't get to China. It was at this opportune time that London Missionary Society veteran missionary Robert Moffat conducted speaking engagements in London. And Robert Moffat inspired David Livingstone as he spoke of the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has been and have never heard the gospel of Christ. And David Livingstone shifted his focus from Asia to Africa. Political events and a speaker coming past at the right time, I'm so glad Livingston shifted his focus from Asia to Africa. He would have probably been a blessing in China, I'm sure. But it's hard to imagine African history without David Livingston. It's hard to believe he could have been more used in China than he was in Africa. It's like David Livingston was made for Africa. While attending a meeting of the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade and the Civilization of Africa in Exeter Hall, 1st of June 1840, Livingston heard Thomas Foxtel Buxton speak of the importance of commerce and Christianity to defeat the slave trade in Africa. Now, Foxtel Buxton was the successor to William Wilberforce. He was a phenomenal force, and the term commerce and Christianity, you need to understand why they were saying this. People in Africa were selling their own children for a pack of needles. The Arab slave traders didn't always have to capture people. They would buy them from chiefs and sometimes from their own family. And so the idea was to defeat slavery, you need commerce. Lawful commerce. And Christianity to have a long-term effect to end the centuries-old, millennium-long-old slave trade. Africans could only be delivered from the slave trade when they had an alternative to selling their own people for the beads and cloth and guns and trinkets that they coveted. So during his final medical exams, David Livingston argued with the board, who were not convinced about the usefulness of the stethoscope. Now today we know the stethoscope's extremely useful, but the medical fraternity back then were convinced it was a fad. Despite Livingston's unorthodox views, they noted, he qualified for a licentiate on the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons in November 1840. Where he studied, the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons. And this is one of his medical chests that he carried. And David Livingston's surgical instrument case, a little daunting looking at that saw there. But they needed it. And this is his pack of instant how to solve most problems. On a bleak November morning, 1840, the Livingston family rose at 5 a.m. and the 27-year-old David read Psalm 121 to his family. He then read Psalm 135. The family bowed in prayer, then Neil walked his son to the Glasgow docks and saw his son embark on his great African adventure. 20th of November, 1840, David Livingston was ordained as a missionary in the Albion Street Chapel. No family members present. They were too poor to afford the travel to London at that time. On the 8th of December, he set sail under George for Cape Town, South Africa. No family members see him off at the port. Too far to travel. David had experienced little childhood, no adolescence in his upbringing. He had little or no play or recreation. Against all odds, he had already achieved far more than he would have thought humanly possible for someone born into such poverty-stricken, disadvantaged background. You know, when people speak about being disadvantaged and poor, I know people with satellite dish in their homes who think they're poor, who've got smartphones and smart shoes, Nike shoes, and they think they're poor. People who eat Kentucky Fried Chicken and drink Coca-Cola who think they're poor. There are people who own two cars in America and satellite dishes who convince they're poor. I don't know many poor people poorer than David Livingston was in his upbringing. And David Livingston was rich compared to Mary Slessor. Mary Slessor was poorer than Livingston. David Livingston at least had parents who loved him. Mary Slessor had an abusive, drunken father who never supported the family. And she had to work to support her mother and daughter and sisters. Her brothers died while she was in. And if you think Mary Slessor was poor, Henry Morton Stanley was even poorer than both of them. He didn't even have parents. And he was abused in the workhouse. So isn't it amazing how these people from some of the most poverty-stricken backgrounds were able to rise to the heights where they could meet Queen Victoria and influence kings and nations and be received in the highest places because of their achievements. So even in Victorian England, people were able to rise from the poorest of disadvantaged backgrounds to the heights, which must have been very hard. I mean, it's hard today, but it's been a lot harder then. To achieve what he had, David Livingston had to be decisive, goal-orientated, and inflexible. He was goal-oriented and inflexible. As time went on, he became less and less flexible, and he showed little or no time for those with lower spans of devotion to Christ and his Great Commission. In fact, on his Zambezi expedition, every one of his white co-workers forsook him, deserted, left him, spoke badly of him, even his own brother. And Livingstone came back after second great missionary journey to not one single person receiving him. Not one person saw him off on his third and final journey to Africa, and shows how fickle the mob and popularity can be. To those who said that work at home must be completed thoroughly before missions could be engaged in abroad, Livingstone responded, "All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard the gospel like a miser. Scotland has the gospel. True, not everyone has submitted to it. But why should we deprive people who have not got the light we have, when there's others who are ignoring the light that's available?" David Livingstone described his 3 months journey by sea to Cape Town. "Our little vessel went reeling and staggering over the waves as if she had been drunk. Our trunks, perpetually breaking from their lashings, were tossed from one side of the cabin to the other. Huddled together in glorious confusion, imagine if you can, a ship in a fit of epilepsy." Very descriptive. David befriended Captain Donaldson and learned all that he could concerning the quadrant and the sextant, and frequently stayed up past midnight to take lunar observations and work out directions using the stars. And a good thing he did, because later he was able to use those to do the first maps of the hinterland of Africa. As the ship rocked and reeled over the perilous seas, Livingstone studied theology. Finally, a raging storm split the foremast of the ship, and they had to put into Rio de Janeiro to have it repaired. You can see coming down from England, Rio's not that far off from that part. Anyway, they had to pop in there before they could come over to Cape Town. David described battling profusely to refuse bottles of liquor that were offered to him from all sides in Brazil. The Brazilians expressed shock that any Englishman should refuse alcohol, for many of his countrymen and seamen had continuously disgraced themselves on the streets of Rio by intoxication. No good for him to point out, "I'm Scottish, not English." David handed out gospel tracts at the notorious waterfront bar, narrowly escaped with his life as 20 drunken, angry sailors assaulted him. Not everyone in Brazil was happy to receive the gospel. After all, he was Protestant, and that was a Catholic country. He engaged in ministry at the local hospital in Rio. He witnessed raging, drunken delirium. He shared the gospel with a dying French sailor, urging him to trust in Christ alone for eternal salvation. So he didn't waste his time in Brazil while his ship was being kitted out with a new foremast. More significantly, in exploring the Amazon jungle nearby, he came across all sorts of bush that he took cuttings of and catalogued, and one of which was the quinine bush, which is indigenous to Brazil. He later found by experimentation that it was the cure for malaria. Now, even when I was growing up in Rhodesia, we called it Livingstone's Rouser, quinine. It was David Livingstone who first identified mosquitoes as the cause of malaria. Now, the scientific community of his time laughed at that. What have mosquitoes got to do with malaria? Everyone knows malaria comes from swamp fever. It's bad air. That's why the solution is tall ceilings. And, I mean, look at the etymology of the word. Malaria. Malaria, bad air. It's swamp fever. It's got nothing to do with insects. And so the whole scientific community laughed and scoffed for 20 years at Livingstone's published speculations that mosquitoes caused. David Livingstone was so observant, he said, "While all mosquitoes can sting you, bite you, only the pregnant female mosquito can give you malaria. And they only tend to do that between about 11 o'clock at night and 5 in the morning." I mean, how many of you have noticed whether you've been bitten by a male mosquito or a female mosquito and whether it's pregnant? But that's how observant this chap was. And this isn't a joke, this is dead serious. He actually, and so he propagated the idea that as long as you were under a mosquito net between about 11 at night and 5 in the morning, you might get bitten, but you won't get malaria if you're under your mosquito net between about 11 at night and 5 in the morning. Now, the scientists laughed at this, as this is ridiculous. There's nothing, mosquitoes have nothing to do with it. No insect can have anything to do with malaria. Well, 20-something years later, they found he was right. He's dead right. And Interestingly enough, on the flyleaf of his book, Missionary Travels and Research in South Africa, he has a tsetse fly. And somebody said, why didn't you put a line? He said, well, actually, the most dangerous creature in Africa is the tsetse fly. A tsetse fly kills so many people and so many horses and oxen and so on. In fact, I had a game ranger say to me when one of us was bitten by, seriously stung by a tsetse fly. Very painful when they go straight through your trousers into your knee. Very painful. Doesn't matter how much cortisone cream you put on, it was just painful for days. And he said, praise God for the tsetse fly. Why? He said, without tsetse flies, we wouldn't have game reserves. Wanky, Etosha, Kruger Park are all tsetse fly areas. And that's why the farmers can't use it for cattle farming, and therefore it's a nature reserve. So he says, praise God for tsetse flies that preserved huge areas of Africa for wildlife. And after that, I didn't feel so bad about being bitten by tsetse fly. But anyway, David Livingstone puts a tsetse fly on his flyleaf. On the 17th of March, 1841, 2 days before his birthday, Livingstone sighted the majestic Table Mountain as the George edged into Table Bay. And thus began one of the most incredible missionary careers of the best friend Africa ever had. He walked across Africa. When he first landed Port Elizabeth off to Cape Town and sailed onto Port Elizabeth, at Algoa Bay he walked. He walked up to Kruderman. That's quite a way to walk. On the way he stopped in Beaufort West, stayed at the Murray family. Now the younger Andrew Murray was not there, he was studying overseas at the time, but Andrew Murray Sr., his father, was there, and he stayed in Livingstone Manse, and he said, Beaufort West is the most beautiful town in Africa that he ever saw. And lovely family and all this. Well, Kruderman is the mission station of LMS. It's the pioneer mission station which Robert Moffat set up. That's where he got his missionary start. But he later explored all through the Kalahari Desert. He walked all the way up into Zambia, Zimbabwe, across Zambia and Angola to the Atlantic. He walked all the way from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, crossing Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique. He later came back, purple, second missionary journey, went all the way around Tanzania, Mozambique, Malawi, all the way up to Zambia and Zimbabwe, Victoria Falls and so on. Third missionary journey, the green, all the way across Tanzania and Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, dying later in Zambia. David Livingstone, the one who proved that the scientific consensus was wrong. The geographers were convinced that the hinterland of Africa was one large desert. He proved that no, the hinterland of Africa is filled with rivers and lakes and mountains and plateaus and savanna and lush, fertile farmland and a lot more. He filled in the map. David Livingstone drew the first maps of the Zambezi River. When he got to Victoria Falls, the first person to name, make known, sketch, and to be able to measure all aspects of Victoria Falls, he noted what a wildlife sanctuary it was, the greatest concentration of wildlife saw anywhere in Africa in his 26 years walking across Africa. The local people were so afraid of it that it had a superstitious hold that people went hunting there, and therefore the wildlife was there in huge herds. There's a lot you can say about Livingstone's career, but praise God for his upbringing. Without his family, without his parents, without the faith, without his congregation, without the people who input in his life, even the missionary newsletters he received directed him to medical missions, and even the political events that redirected him from China to Africa, we might not have experienced that work. And so, any questions about the life, the family, the upbringing, the family of David Livingstone? Yes.
Did he learn any local languages, or did he just...
He was a linguist. In fact, I'd say William Carey and David Livingstone definitely had the gift of tongues in the most real sense. They were able to handle languages. So David Livingstone was extraordinary in that he tended to preach without translators. Maybe he used a translator early in his work when he was working amongst the Tswana people in Kuruman area, but he very quickly started preaching local languages. And he'd acquired the languages, and he got so good in being able to preach, and for example, to Chewa and Swahili, he was able to make himself known well enough that he didn't tend to preach in Turkey. He preached in languages. He acquired the languages, and with observation, his notebooks full of creating his own vocabularies and dictionaries. Amazing. So this was somebody who really tried to communicate the gospel in the language of the people. Very amazing. Yes, other questions, comments? Back in 2013, the 200th anniversary of David Livingstone's birth, I launched the Livingstone 200. And we had a Livingstone 200 mission. We went over 7 months to all 12 countries he went to. We cheated, we drove. And ended off at Victoria Falls for Livingstone 200 conference at the Victoria Falls, which overran 16 November, which is the date when he discovered, named, mapped Victoria Falls. We've produced a whole lot of different audios, and he's, of course, got a chapter on the Great Century of Missions, chapter on Victorious Christians Who Changed the World, audios. We've got a chapter on Livingstone and sketches from South African history as well. So, any other questions? Ryan.
Have any of Livingstone's siblings entered the ministry or the mission field?
Yes. His one brother, Charles, joined him for his work in Africa, but only for a couple of years, less than that, almost maybe 18 months or so. Then he was one of those who gave up, went back to England and badmouthed his brother. Sadly. Yes.
So how long did he work in the continent?
26 years. 26 years. And he walked from coast to coast across Africa. The first person to do it. From east to west, from west to east. Across the continent. Absolutely stunning.
Was that his mission?
Well, no. In fact,
no, but was his mission time 26 years?
Yes.
Because the question was, how long was he in the continent?
Both. Yes. So he came to Africa as a missionary. He stayed in Africa as a missionary. He had three great missionary journeys. So for the first many years, he was based at Kuruman, London Missionary Society, preaching, teaching, building churches, building homes, going around and ministering to people. But at a certain point, he saw the need for massive exploration. Now, he tended to take his family with him on missionary journeys. And on one of his first attempts, when he went into Botswana, one of his children, Elizabeth, died in the field. And all of his children and his wife came down sick. When he came back by ox cart into Kuruman, you can imagine his mother-in-law was not impressed. And he was berated for his irresponsibility in taking his family with him into the field. So, he walked the family, well, they were in Oxford, but he was walking alongside, all the way back to Cape Town, put his family on a boat, shipped them off to Scotland to be with family, and then he embarked on his massive first missionary journey, 4 years, walking across Africa. So he is criticized for taking his family in the field, he is criticized for leaving his family and not taking them into the field. On a second missionary journey, his wife, Mary Moffat, joined him. And she died in Mozambique of malaria. Because their porters were tired of carrying the heavy weights and emptied the medicine box into the Zambezi. She started carrying an empty box, and when they needed it, he didn't have the quinine needed that would save her life. Amazing that he didn't lose his mind, which he almost did, and his faith, and stopped serving Africa. But he carried on. So,
that was his mission. But how long did he work when he was 10 years old in the cotton mills? Oh,
he worked for 10 years in the cotton mills.
Okay.
As a piecer, and then 2 years as a supervisor. So he was 12 years in the cotton mills, and then he was 26 years working as a missionary in Africa under the London Missionary Society. Now, he is at first pretty static, but his vision was to set up a Bible college and train African missionaries and ministers. He was overruled by the mission society, who said, no, that they're not ready for that yet. So he was frustrated that he wasn't allowed to train African missionaries and ministers, which he thought was the best thing to do. And out of that frustration of being blocked by the mission leadership, he decided to get into more exploration. And the more he explored, the more he came across slavery, and the more he decided he needed to expose it. And so his explorations actually achieved more than he would have. I believe his vision of African Bible culture was superb. But, in fact, he achieved more, personally, by helping to deal a death knell to the slave trade in Africa and inspire more people in the mission field, so that in the end, the effect of the gospel is so much stronger. So it wasn't his first plan. It wasn't the second plan. But the Lord worked despite the frustrations. I mean, despite the British government, the Chinese government, the Rothschilds, the Opium War, that wasn't good, but that redirects him to Africa. London Ministry Society saying no to Bible colleges and so on, wasn't a good plan. I think that's the wrong decision. And yet, what man meant for evil, God used for good. God works all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Cameron. No, he did not translate the Bible to any languages. He was good enough to speak the gospel to people. He healed bodies, and he was the first to proclaim the gospel in many, many, many villages, languages, and areas. But no, he didn't stay long enough to translate the Bible. That was not his calling or gifting. Well, he would have been good at it if he had tried, because he's good at languages. But I think there was a restless in him that required him to walk. His training was exploring and walking. Other people, like William Wilberforce, with great Bible translation. Well, his father-in-law, Robert Moffat, did the first translation of the Bible into an indigenous language, the Tswana language. So his father-in-law was a phenomenal pioneer missionary. We'll look at Robert Moffat another day. But David Livingstone, I think, was unique as the pioneer. He opened up Africa to the gospel, really. Yes?
Where did he meet the Moffats?
So, the first time, because he joined the London Missionary Society. So understand, London Missionary Society was the congregational missionary society, basically. So you had the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge, which is Anglican. You had the Church Missionary Society, which was the Evangelical Anglican Missionary Society. You had the Baptist Missionary Society, and so on. Well, the London Missionary Society was basically for the independents, which meant the congregational churches. So he is already a congregational because his family had moved from the Presbyterians into the congregational movement. And so it's natural that he is now exposed to the London Missionary Society. He also works in China. But still, it was Robert Moffat that he met at a mission society meeting in London that redirected him to Africa. And, of course, that's where he met his future wife, Mary. Mary Moffat actually nursed him after he got mauled by a lion. And, you know, he wasn't expected to survive. He had crushed shoulder and all sorts of things. Still had teeth marks in his bones till the end of his life from the line. And so Livingstone, you can actually go to Kuruman, which is a well-preserved mission station today, and see the tree where he proposed to Mary Moffat and things like that. And of the Moffats, 7 children, 5 went into missionary work. Robert Moffat was one of the pallbearers for his son-in-law. Robert Moffat lived much longer than David Livingstone did. Henry Morton Stanley might have had the forward front left position on the cast, but his father-in-law was also one of the coffin bearers when Livingstone's body was finally brought back to Westminster Abbey. Yes.
The common theme for all of these people, very tough life. Even Captain Cook, who I was reading about, watching a video about, you know, quite Christian, strong Christian beliefs and upbringing. But is this not the reason that all the colonialists left Britain and went and colonized anyway? Was that not the... I mean, you're just taking 4 or 5 people and you're seeing that everybody was struggling. Is that not why the whole of South Africa, why this whole colonialism thing, why we here, why everybody's in America, why everybody's in Australia, because there were land clearances in Scotland, there was Irish fake famine, it wasn't a famine, they were just deprived of their own food, and it was kind of a collectivization 1.0 of land. Is there something that happened that we just deleted from our history?
That's a good observation. Yeah. Things were harsh there. You just think of the Vikings too. Those Vikings who lived in these very frozen, frigid extremes of Norway and Denmark. No wonder they went looking for new climes where the sun shone more than a few days a year. And the conditions in Britain are often very harsh, and for the Scottish and Irish particularly harsh. And British government policy was particularly harsh. I find it amazing that, for example, the grandfather of David Livingstone had no vindictiveness or resentment. He didn't breed a sense of resentment or chip on the shoulder with his grandson. David Livingstone never had a chip on the shoulder, and to think of the upbringing he had, it was very deprived. Yet when he was given a chance to meet with Queen Victoria, he didn't go there and gripe. He used his influence to try and persuade them to mobilize against the slave trade in Africa. So he wasn't coming in saying, you know, what a deprived upbringing I had in Scotland and British policy in Scotland is bad. Isn't it interesting how they were more concerned with others? Very different from today, where people are quick to take in a grievance on their own. But you've got something there. The conditions were so harsh back in England, maybe coming out to Africa didn't seem like much of a sacrifice. Because he was brought up in such abject poverty, stepping out of his comfort zone wasn't that difficult.
Another thing that's similar to Captain Cook is Captain Cook discovered what was causing malaria. He really worked it out of the system by experimenting with his crew, and he went on the length of the journey that he went on to have fresh.
You think of scurvy?
Scurvy.
Yes.
Yeah, he got a bit of scurvy, figured out what was causing it, not eating like fresh fruits and vegetables, and clean water. And it's just interesting that they both had all these people that such similar sort of upbringings, and then similar attention to like these more detailed and focusing on
problem solving. Finding a solution to something that's just such a major problem. I must say, the attention to detail of David Livingstone, but also, you know, you read, for example, Lady Anne Bonnard's diaries coming to the Cape in the 1700s, and her attention to detail, her inner art and her sketches and her diary, and think, wow.
Isn't there art
in Newlands
Forest?
Yes. So, I mean, we wander around. You know, we can wander the same territory, and we don't see what others are observant enough to spot those things which can improve things. So it's a real gift to be able to see needs and to trust God to learn what the solution may be to those needs. But think of what a problem malaria is and how many of our lives have been saved by quinine. And it was David Livingstone who was not meant to be a professional scientist, and yet he's the one who pioneered the solution to malaria.
What churches or denominations follow up on Livingstone's work and the type of villages that he
had? Yes. So, for example, in Malawi, the Church Missionary Society, which was the Anglican Church of England's Missionary Society, sent out Bishop Mackenzie. Oh, now Bishop Mackenzie, he's a character. Bishop Mackenzie's letters back are about the different benefits of different rifles and repeating rifles and how he's able to take out slave traders. And I mean, talk about a fighting bishop. He came out with such zeal, he made David Livingstone look a little lethargic when it came to fighting slave traders. And Bishop Mackenzie brought out a lot of university students from the Anglican background, so they were Oxford and Cambridge students coming out. So Malawi was heavily evangelized by them. So there's the Church Missionary Society, the London Missionary Society, and then there was the Presbyterians also came very strongly. Dutch Reformed Church in particular moved into Malawi a lot. So Livingstone's appeal was not made just to his denomination. Because as a Congregationalist, he is open to all. He's very wide. And he was followed up by a wide range. I'd say through most of Central Africa, the Church Missionary Society probably did the most. The Presbyterians did a lot in Malawi in particular. The Baptist Missionary Society, less so. They seemed more intrigued with what's going on in China. And the Baptists did move in quite large numbers into Congo, but not so much into Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe, which is where Livingstone started his work. Livingstone was the first messenger of mercy in so many parts of Africa. We set up this website, Livingstone 200, back in 2013, and I've put a whole lot of links there. I set up a Dr. David Livingstone Facebook page. It's got a lot of traffic. Livingstone Fellowship website as well, a lot of Bible surveys and sermons. Today, people can travel to Blantyre, to the actual Livingstone Museum, and they've, of course, very nicely done that. It doesn't look anything like it would have looked at that time, really. It's been beautifully painted, and they've got a globe fountain in the center. And they've got, personally, I don't like this. I think this is very bad propaganda for Lions, against Lions, because you don't see a rifle. I mean, where's the rifle? David Livingstone shot this poor lion. The lion was minding his own business, lying on a rock, and some chief had convinced him that he had to go and shoot this lion. I think chief just wanted a lion skin. And so he lied to Livingstone that this lion was eating his goats, which the chance of a lion wasting his time on goats, I mean, goats are nothing compared to zebras and so on. This lion wasn't damaged or injured or anything like that. And so here you've got a picture of the lion attacking or a statue, but there's no rifle. I mean, this makes it look like the lion just attacked Livingstone while he was minding his own business, walking down the street and just got mugged by this lion. That's just not true. So Livingstone himself, by the way, at the time wouldn't have looked this old either. He was basically a youngster at the time. So I think they've also got him too old in this particular picture. The size difference between the lion and the person is probably accurate. And their teeth are like that, yes. I've been close enough to see. So I think this is, you know, while I'm generally on Livingstone's side, on this one I'm on the lion's side, because he did admit later in life it was the dumbest thing he ever did. Picking a fight to the lion, he shot the lion, who was lying on a rock minding his own business. The lion leapt up with a heavy slug from an elephant rifle in his shoulder. The lion went for Livingstone, and he said, Livingstone said, he shook me like a dog shakes a rat. And ultimately the lion died from the gunshot, but not before he hadn't crushed the shoulder of David Livingstone. For the rest of his life, in cold weather, he would feel that agony in his shoulder and realize, leave lions alone. Now, in the rest of his life, all of his years going across Africa, he's never attacked by lion any other time than when he first shot the lion. So this business of lion, Livingstone was attacked by a lion. I had a Scottish missionary who was working with our mission up in Zambia, setting up our Bible college some years ago. And he said lions had been seen in our territory that we had the Bible college, Covenant College. He wanted to send up a rifle. I said, "You're not going to shoot any lion on our mission grounds." And he said, I said, "Leave the lions alone, they'll leave you alone." He said, "But a lion attacked Livingstone." I said, "Because he first shot him." Leave the lions alone. I've been in a wild where lions been as close to me as Ryan is for me right now. Maybe closer. Nothing between us. I mean, I wasn't in the car. There was just a bit of bush and fresh air between us. I mean, he looked at me very carefully. And I just sort of bowed and showed respect. He's the king. And moved away quietly and slowly. He looked at me carefully, but I mean, like, back off. You know. Now, if there'd been lion cubs around, I might have been in serious trouble. But you leave the lions alone, they'll leave you alone. And Livingstone broke a cardinal rule. And just think of it, for his whole life, walking across the whole continent, no lion ever attacked him, except when he attacked first. You draw first blood. Even if you've killed that lion with a shot, he can still crush your bones before he dies. I mean, make no mistake. Anyone who thinks he can take out a lion and remain unharmed. There's some stupid hunters out there. The pictures, there's videos of a man hunting a lion, you know, being filmed doing it, shoots a lion, and the lion, even from a still position, still leaps over and rips this hunter to pieces before the lion dies. And, you know, look at it and think, why don't you just leave him alone? Anyway, so this is one of the monuments to David Livingstone. There's some magnificent churches. This is a church where he worshipped in, and they've got memorials to David Livingstone all over the world. This is in Livingstone, the city in Zambia. Church stained glass windows. Malawi. How do you like this? Scotland used to put them on their currency. Malawi, they've printed stamps for David Livingstone. Of course, in Blantyre, there's a lovely statue of him sowing the word of God. In Ujiji, there's a wall commemorating where on the 10th of November, 1871, Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingstone, said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume," under this mango tree, 10th of December, 1871. I think the most iconic of all the statues is on the Zimbabwe side of Victoria Falls, and this was produced in 1955 on the centenary of David Livingstone naming and mapping Victoria Falls. I think this is just such a magnificent portrayal of the man. It shows superior craftsmanship. And wherever he has been, there are mementos and memorials. Livingstone Museum in Zambia. And in 2005, the Zambian government put up a new monument on the Zambian side of Victoria Falls to sort of rival the one on the Zimbabwe side. And they're still putting up monuments to David Livingstone. In fact, I noticed 8 statues to David Livingstone just on the Zambian side, just in the city of Livingstone when we were there in 2013. So, other questions, comments? Anything, David Livingstone? Andrea?
Did God preserve his clothes, or how did he start wearing, like, for 4 years?
Yes, I complain to the tailor and the shoemaker regularly. Why do my boots fall apart after a couple of hikes up Tate Mountain? How did David Livingstone manage to walk across the continent without his shoes falling apart? This is pathetic workmanship. And I bought brand new boots from Cape Ewan Moss. One hike up Tate Mountain, the sole's coming off, and I took it back and said, "Yeah, if I was walking across Africa like David Livingstone, how long would this last me? Just one hike." And that's pathetic workmanship. Is this made in China? No, we make it here in Cape Town. Well, got to do a better job than this. So, first of all, I think they really made things better. Secondly, he had to repair things. There's no doubt we've seen stitching and so on. Do I have a pair of his boots? Got it somewhere. Maybe not here. Anyway, I've got a picture of his boots at one particular point, and you could see multiple sewings, you know, through the leather. Must have a very strong thumb to get the needle through. It's in a machine to get the needle through leather. Oh. Yeah. Any other comments? Questions? So we've got these books here. We've got a whole range of different books. And we've got letters of David Livingstone. That's his handwriting, his diaries. We've got a whole lot of his books and materials and first editions. Magnificent, magnificent pictures. Henry Morton Stanley, of course. This is Livingstone House, so we've got quite a collection of first editions of Livingstone's travels. By the way, one of our Livingstone travels books somebody sent to us several years ago, and it's had inside University of Tennessee. Stamp discarded. In pencil in top corner, $2. A university took a first edition of Livingstone's travels, threw it in a box to be sold at something, and some lucky person picked it up for $2. If you check on Amazon and so on, first edition, Livingstone's travels, a cheap one will be $1,200, more likely $2,000 to $2,500 if they've got all the maps and they're well preserved. And the University of Tennessee threw it away for $2. This is what's going on in colleges all over the world. They're discarding great historic books. We need to protect libraries. But people don't value these first editions, and especially not the average university these days. The average university has contempt for its Christian heritage, and they are throwing the books out for a lot of garbage. And I know this because our local Pinelands Town, Pinelands Library, where I took my children many years, there's so many good books there. Then after a while, you couldn't find them. We know why. They were throwing them out in order to make space for the modern garbage that had to be brought in. You know, books on Steve Bicker and things like that. Joe Slovo. And so, you know, who needs Livingstone? One of the best libraries I've come across, second-hand bookshops, is in Hermanus, Hemingway's. And I was looking at it. Your books are phenomenal. Where did you get them? The man said, "You'd weep to know. Tell me." He said, "We got word to get the biggest vehicle we had and rush down to Cape Town Library. They were throwing books out in the dumpster. And they saved as much as they could. They were heading to be pulped hundreds, no, thousands of great books. You know, some leather-bound, hardcover, phenomenal things. Things that would be worth a fortune. Just." And some second-hand bookshops were pawning. I went to the library of the Footrick Monument up in Pretoria. And in their Erfenis Heritage Library, which is kept in controlled climates and all of that, halon gas warning lights for they would flood if there's any fire to protect the books. Where do you get these books from? And he said, we were informed that Pretoria Library was going to be throwing out books. And so we went down, there were several trucks, and we rescued as much as we could. Thousands of books. These included the only copies of some family manuscripts and masters and doctoral theses and a whole lot of, you know, first editions and so on. And a lot of them are in our heritage library. So some people, just at the right time, managed to save these things from being thrown away. There's a war against our heritage. There's a war against history. If you've got good books, preserve them. Now, we're known as a literature ministry. And there's literature ministries in America where people donate a whole lot of books to, and they ship them all over the world. And we get some of these supplies. These are people who take grandma's library and just shipping it off to Africa or where, whatever. Churches are closed down. Hotels are closed down. All the Gideon's Bibles, what's happening to them. And so there's some literature ministries that gather everything together. And then they ship it out to ministries like us. And we donate them to libraries and so on. So at this moment, there's a lot of great resources being either discarded or inherited by some grandchildren who don't know the value. And just give it somewhere. And you would be amazed what treasures are to be found even in this age. So, any other comments, observations?
With the books, can they, when they're rescue books, are they doing any sort of digital recording of the book, take photos of each page and then PDF it so that they can't actually get rid of it?
That is the way to go. I know that Portugal Monument's doing that.
That's great.
But they're only focusing on South African history. My goal, if we can get just the right equipment and staff, I'm wanting to digitize all of our Rhodesia books, which is heritage. We've got the largest complete selection of Rhodesia heritage books here at Livingston House, and I'd like it all digitized. We've scanned a lot of pictures, but we need to go more than that. We've actually got original 16mm Rhodesia Information Service films, many of which have not yet been digitized. So I think the solution is to digitize everything, but of course one needs volunteers, personnel, time, resources. But there are some doing it, but we've got to do a lot more. And my goal is when we get it digitized, upload to web, put on flash drives, digital libraries, give to all the different societies around the world that can use it, because we don't want to lose these things.